everyone, and welcome to the court. The case this morning is United States v. Smith. Mr. Hockenberry, are you prepared to argue on behalf of appellant? And Captain Wright, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, sir.
Please proceed.
Your Honor, could I reserve 5 minutes?
Granted.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Scott Hockenberry, along with Major Heather Kane. We represent the appellant, Airman Caleb Smith. She was taking observations, putting them all together, and then drawing a conclusion as to something she had no memory of. That is reflection and deliberation, and that is not an excited utterance. And those are direct quotes from the record. The military judge, with no analysis, admitted the statement, "I think he raped me," made after an entire morning of reflection and deliberation, despite the fact that the declarant had no memory of the underlying events. By definition, one can make an inference that a deductive conclusion about an event the declarant has no memory of has to be the product of conscious thought. But in this case, there's no need for an inference because reflection and deliberation were directly and explicitly endorsed in the 39A. Relatedly, the victim was not under the stress of a startling event. Several hours, quite a number of hours, passed between waking up and sending the message, and during that time, she engaged in a significant range of intervening activities.
Counsel, on that point, the government's position seems to be that the startling event was not the alleged sexual assault, but the shock of looking in the mirror and seeing the bruises, and that wasn't several hours later. We don't have any analysis by the military judge on that very specific disagreement between you and the government, if I'm correct about that. How do we figure out what the startling event was?
Thank you, Your Honor. I really think that goes to the heart of this issue, and, you know, frankly, very well could be dispositive to this case. And our position, of course, is that a subsequent event cannot trigger a new opportunity for ongoing excited utterances about a past event. That would be inconsistent with this court's precedent and inconsistent with the rationale behind the excited utterance exception.
Mr. Hockenberry, can you explore that a little bit more, expand upon that point? Consistent with what you were just saying, on page 5 of your reply brief, after indicating that you believe that the government misunderstood the argument there, you say, when the statement in question is directly about the charged event, it would have to be made while under the stress thereof, meaning under the stress of the charged event. What language in the rule are you pointing at that supports that?
Your Honor, I think we would point to this court's discussion in Donaldson that, and okay, frankly,
if we could break it down. So you're not, essentially what I'd like to first look at is there any language in the rule that says that? Then look at whether there is any case law that would support that approach.
Yes, Your Honor, I think we are looking more to case law to say that the idea that a subsequent event could trigger sort of perpetually ongoing excited utterances would be inconsistent with case law.
And how so?
The rationale that an excited utterance must be made without the opportunity to deliberate or fabricate only makes sense if the utterance is about an event that just happened. If the utterance is about an event that happened at an indeterminate time in the past, by definition, there's been opportunity.
But where is that inherent in the language of the rule? It talks about a startling event. So why can't, and goes to the point that Judge Meggs was getting at, is what are we determining is the startling event? Why can't it be the startling event is either A, the discovery of the bruises, or B, her, as you note, she pieces things together with the sudden realization of, I've been sexually assaulted. Why can those not be the startling events as contemplated under the language of the rule?
Right. Your Honor, again, we would look to the rationale behind the rule, and again, it would be more from case law, perhaps, than the text of the rule. But this Court, again, in Donaldson said, where a statement relating to a startling event does not immediately follow that event, there's a strong presumption against admissibility, and similarly.
But if the startling event is either the discovery of the bruises or the realization of the sexual assault, why wasn't she still under the effect of that startling event? She was talking about a very short period of time, 3 minutes. She was shaking, sweating, frantic, panicked. Well, so why wouldn't that fit under the rule and under our precedents?
Your Honor, we don't necessarily take issue with the fact that the discovery of the bruises could be a triggering, startling event for excited utterance purposes. We would have liked to see more analysis of that, but that's very possible. However, it could only trigger an excited utterance about that event. It could not trigger an excited utterance about an event that happened the day before or a week before or a month before. And
just to clarify, so if she had said, I have bruises, then that would qualify as an excited utterance about the discovery of the bruises. But because she said, or texted, I think I've been raped, and that requires, the distinction I guess you're drawing is that requires some logical steps beyond just looking at the bruises, or is it that she's now describing or talking about an event that is hours in the past?
Yes, Your Honor, I think it's both. In terms of the third prong of the Arnold test, proximity to the startling event, a statement about the bruises would have proximity to the startling event. But a statement about the sexual act, which happened the day before, would not have that temporal proximity. And related, but also a separate grounds for our objection to this admission of this testimony, is the opportunity for reflection. And on this record, not just the opportunity, but the explicit endorsement of reflection, and that would go to the first prong of the Arnold test.
Now let me tease that out a little bit, though. In terms of her having an opportunity to reflect, you seem to adopt the position in your brief that, in fact, she had no memory of the event. So until that time that she sees those bruises in the mirror, if she has no memory, if she has no knowledge of the sexual assault, how is she engaging in any types of opportunity to think of things such as, how am I going to explain this to my boyfriend that I've just had sex with this other person? If during that whole time until she goes through the deductions, she doesn't even have knowledge of the fact that she did engage in sex or was sexually assaulted by the accused.
Yes, Your Honor, and we would, the lack of memory, we would say is additionally objectionable, both due to the interplay between the rationale for, part of the rationale for excited utterances is that the memory is fresh. And that could not be true if we adopt this expansion of the exception to include subsequent events temporally. But there's additional application here where she has no memory of the event. But with respect to the deliberation, she's been deliberating all morning. She said when she woke up.
But that's my point. How could she deliberate about the sexual assault when she couldn't remember the sexual assault until looking in the mirror and seeing the bruises? And then we've got a 3-minute process of her engaging in inferences, deductions about what had happened.
I think she's I don't necessarily think, and I hope I'm answering the question, that you would have to remember an event to deliberate about it. In fact, it's her lack of memory that makes the deliberation necessary to forming a conclusion. And she has been deliberating all morning. She talks about her deliberation when she wakes up. She's freaking out and panicking and notices soreness and bleeding, and she's thinking about it. She thinks it was weird. And she's thinking about it, but she shrugs it off. And then she's thinking about it more when she's looking for her underwear.
I'm sorry, to that end, if she were to have made a similar statement or text a similar message right after she awakened in the conditions that you just described, in the same bed, arm over her, you know, she gets up, goes to the bathroom, she has the vaginal bleeding. If she had made a statement at that point, would, under your theory, would that have qualified for an excited utterance?
Your Honor, that would certainly be a much better case for an excited utterance under both prongs, or both the first and third prongs of the Arnold test, due to the proximity to the event and also due to the more limited opportunity to reflect and deliberate, and also the more limited actual reflection and deliberation. So I think in that case there would be certainly a much better argument that it would qualify.
But would she not also still be reacting to the circumstances? She still doesn't remember. In your theory, she just still does not remember the actual event, the sexual assault, the alleged sexual assault. So yeah, draw the distinction for me.
Right.
Other than temporally.
Yes, Your Honor, I think that would quell some of our concerns with the first and third prong of the Arnold test. But it would not address the concern that she doesn't remember the event. And that goes both to the competency of the testimony in the first place, but also to the inherent deliberation in forming a conclusion about an event that one does not remember.
Counsel, suppose we accept your view that this statement should not have been admitted. Could you go through the prejudice analysis? What I'm particularly concerned about is it doesn't seem like that her statement is particularly probative of anything. Now, maybe a little prejudicial, but it doesn't seem like it goes to any of the specific elements that couldn't have been proved otherwise. It's just sort of a legal conclusion. And so, it was improperly admitted, but how did it prejudice the accused?
Your Honor, we say in our brief, and I don't think this is an exaggeration, that the government made this statement the central theme of its case. They open with it, they start, finish, they're closing with it, it's in the middle of the closing, it's the beginning of their closing PowerPoint. The government at trial uses this statement at every opportunity. I think that's independently relevant to evaluating prejudice, as this court said in Edwards. But it's also telling on a broader point, the nature of the evidence here. There was a vulnerability in the government evidence in that they did not have competent evidence of an actual accusation or an actual statement of non-consent due to the lack of memory. And they used this hearsay statement as a proxy for that gap in their evidence. And repeatedly, in closing, the government said, she came to the realization that he raped her, and you, the panel, the fact finder, should come to that same conclusion and find that he is guilty. So the improper evidence went to the exact area of the government's case where it was most vulnerable.
If you had objected at trial, defense counsel objected that it was not relevant, would it have been excludable on grounds it wasn't relevant?
Your Honor, I think that ties in with our competency argument that she did not witness these events and therefore was not competent to testify about them. You could say that makes it irrelevant in a legal standard. Of course, I think to Your Honor's point, if it's irrelevant, how can it be prejudicial? But if you look to the use, and this is a panel case, the use was so prevalent and went directly to the area that was most in controversy, that's where we see the prejudice.
Mr. Huckenberry, can you remind me again on the sequence of events at trial? I thought what happened, and, you know, getting older, so I might be wrong, but I thought the witness, the victim here, testified earlier as to the content of the statement now at issue. And then, and of course there was no objection. And then the objection comes later when we're trying to admit this other evidence. And the objection at that time is that, as I recall, that this evidence was cumulative, presumably because the witness had already testified to it. So on the issue of prejudice, I know you allude to, or you discussed this a little bit in your brief, but going back to Judge Maggs' question on the issue of prejudice, how then do we make a prejudice analysis if the testimony contains some of the same content of the statement that we're all arguing about here today?
Chief Judge Olson, I see my
first question.
Correct me if I'm wrong about my memory of the sequence of events.
You know, Your Honor, that is an accurate recitation of the record. We would say first that the text message was more prejudicial than the testimony that went back with the panel. The government put it in their closing PowerPoint. But more fundamentally, the analysis for the testimony, the hearsay analysis for the testimony, would be identical to the hearsay analysis for the prosecution exhibit.
Let me stop you there for a second. You said because it went back to the members in the deliberations, is it because it was in the context of all the discussion back and forth? There wasn't just that one statement in the text. There was a back and forth kind of conversation.
Well, Your Honor, just but referring to that.
Why is it more prejudicial just because it went back to the with the members?
I beg your pardon, Your Honor. Just because it was an exhibit that they took back to the deliberation room as opposed to just testimony.
Relying on their memory? Wouldn't the testimony of a witness be more vivid in the minds of the members than the following somewhat cumulative text message?
Well, I would think that the...
It's a rhetorical kind of question, so I'm not going to hold you to your answer.
Yes, Your Honor. I would think a piece of physical evidence that they took back would be more impactful. But I think the analysis takes a step back and is more fundamental in terms of if the prosecution exhibit was improper hearsay, then so was the testimony. So while the objection came late and came when prosecution exhibit 2 was offered, the military judge's ruling, had the military judge properly excluded this, that ruling would logically have to extend.
Right, but we're talking about prejudice now, that he didn't exclude it. It came in, and the issue that you've raised with us, and I apologize, Chief, for going over time, the issue you've raised with us is that this text message is prejudicial.
Your Honor, my impression of the granted issue is that it would include both the text message and the prior testimony. And our position is that had the military judge properly excluded the text message, that ruling would have extended to the testimony, either by the inevitable defense request or by the judge would at that point had a sua sponte duty to instruct the panel to disregard the prior testimony and perhaps viewing it in the least favorable standard of review to the defense, even absent what happened later with the prosecution exhibit, if we view the admission of the prior testimony without objection as forfeited error and therefore reviewed for plain error, we would submit that even in isolation it was plain error to allow that hearsay about an event the victim did not remember and had been deliberating on all morning.
Okay. Any further questions from the bench? Thank you, Mr. Huckenberry. Captain Wright?
Thank you. Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Captain Jocelyn Wright, and along with Colonel Naomi Dennis, we represent the United States. The standard of review for admitting evidence affords the military judge considerable discretion, and the standard of review for legal sufficiency asks whether any rational trier of fact could have found appellant guilty of sexual assault. With those standards in mind, this court should affirm for two reasons. First, the military judge did not abuse his discretion when he admitted the statement, "I think he raped me," as an excited utterance, because it related to the startling event of discovering bruises all over her upper body. Second, drawing every reasonable inference from the evidence in favor of the prosecution, a reasonable fact finder could find that appellant sexually assaulted the victim when she was so drunk that she urinated on herself twice, and appellant admitted what he did was wrong because the victim was, quote, too drunk, end quote.
If I may ask a preliminary question, why is the judge's legal ruling here entitled to an abuse of discretion standard? Essentially, he just said the foundational elements are met, comes in. Why should this court apply the abuse of discretion standard?
Yes, Your Honor. The court should apply the abuse of discretion standard because there's evidence in the record to support the ruling. Though he didn't make particular findings of fact, he goes through or he takes the time for an Article 39A hearing where he asks that the victim be brought back up to testify specifically about these text messages and specifically about what she was feeling during that time frame. He also says to the circuit trial counsel before beginning the testimony, he says any time frame outside of the statements in the gas station would cut against your excited utterance argument. So there he's showing that he is looking for particular information about excited utterance and that analysis.
It seems to be, though, a little bit of a distinction here in terms of process and substance. He did go through that process that you're talking about. But typically for an abuse of discretion standard to apply, we're looking for the military judge to put on the record the analysis. Where do we find that here?
We do not find an explicit analysis, Your Honor. We would agree with that. However, it's not clear error. The choice to admit this statement as an excited utterance is still not clear error because there's the evidentiary foundation there. Stated that she was freaked out and panicked. These are the emotions that show she was startled. And then she says that she saw bruises on her chest and arms. She said it in her testimony, but she also said it in her text messages to her friend. So in Prosecution Exhibit 2, she initially says, "I think he raped me." Her friend has some questions to check if she's okay. And then she says, quote, "I noticed a hickey on my neck and then saw handprints on my boobs," end quote, indicating that for her what was top of mind was the discovery of the bruises. Seeing those bruises on her body then resulted in this set of text messages.
Captain Wright, you don't have to, but let me ask you, would you be willing to concede, not you personally, but your government team, that this particular issue, evidentiary issue, this excited utterance, is kind of a very different, almost anomalous situation to which this exception might be applied? Would you, if we were to agree with the government and say this is an excited utterance, came in properly, would you agree that this is at the far edges of what we're talking about in the rules of evidence? You don't have to. I'm just asking.
Your Honor, I would not say this is at the far edges. There just is not a lot of case law where this particular issue has come up at the appellate level. But there are a few cases that show where, in this instance, a startling event comes after the offense itself. So United States versus Lucia, which is a 10th Circuit unpublished case. In that situation, we had a child who saw her rapist a few months after the rape actually occurred, and she made an excited utterance to her teacher at that point. In United States v. Abel, which is an Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals case, it was cited in our brief for under the prejudice analysis, but it also has the excited utterance of an accused of the appellant in that case. Ultimately, his excited utterance was not, there was some deliberation there, so the judge determined it wasn't actually an excited utterance, but his was the result of being accused of a crime. So we do have some case law, though not a lot, where the excited utterance comes after a startling event that's not the offense.
I see. But you have, I guess the best you could do is you'd have to say this is uncommon.
It is uncommon, Your Honor. Hmm. However, it's still within the bounds of the rule. The rule itself does not say that the startling event or condition needs to be the offense itself. The rule says that a statement relating to a startling event, and the statement has to be made while under the stress of the event. So there's no qualifier on the type of event itself.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Should we be concerned about broadening the edges of a rule like this? I mean, if we were to agree with you, you've at least conceded that this is uncommon. Should it be more common? Should we extend the rule to this and every kind of scenario like this? I mean, they're all not going to be the same. There's always going to be some twist or turn in each factual scenario. Should we be concerned about that?
Your Honor, I don't believe that it's an exception or an expansion of the rule. Arnold and Donaldson, the cases of this court, require a totality of the circumstances analysis when looking at any excited utterance. And I believe that the government believes that this type of statement, this type of situation, does fit within Arnold, and similar situations could also fit. But again, looking at Donaldson, for example, we have the six different criteria that the courts need to go through to determine whether or not it should be admitted. This fits within those circumstances, though uncommon. It's still within the bounds of the existing rule.
Okay. And I don't want to monopolize Chief questioning, but I do have another question.
Please go ahead.
Yeah. How do you respond to, and I know you do it in your brief, but I kind of like the conversational approach. How do you respond to the appellant's claim on prejudice?
Yes, Your Honor.
You've heard what Mr. Hockenberry says is the reason why he and his client believe this text message is prejudicial, and he kind of hooks it up or connects it with the actual testimony about the same statement that the witness made.
Your Honor, the statement, I think, to you, rate me, it didn't provide any additional ammunition against the appellant. So the statement was not prejudicial to the appellant. It was entered in for, or it was admitted for the truth of the matter in that statement, meaning she thought that she was raped. It was her belief, her opinion, that she had been raped. And that fact is already obvious because she reported to her friend immediately, both the friend she texted as well as another friend when she was back on Fort Gordon. And then she testified at a court-martial where appellant was accused of sexually assaulting her. So all of these other components, other testimony that occurred, prove up the exact same evidence that she thought she was raped. So therefore, it's not additional ammunition. It is a consideration. In addition, the government used the statement as a theme, but they didn't use it substantively to show that appellant, in fact, raped the victim. So it was a theme in their case, essentially to tie the concepts together, but it wasn't as impactful as, say, the appellant's own statements or the sexual assault forensic exam or the DNA evidence that were all presented at trial. The government's case there was quite strong against the appellant.
Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. The startling event in this case was the discovery of the bruises, and when made the statement, "I think he raped me," she was under the stress from that startling event. The military judge did not abuse his discretion in admitting the statement as an excited utterance. It was not clear error or arbitrary that he did so.
Counsel, what if we disagree with you that this startling event was the discovery of the bruises? Does the government concede that if that wasn't the startling event, then, and if the startling event, say, as the appellant would urge us to believe, the assault itself, does the government concede that then this was not an excited utterance?
So, Your Honor, the time frame does cut against us, Your Honor. The time frame set out in Jones, time is not dispositive of the event, but the longer the time frame between the startling event and the actual statement, it does cut against the excited utterance. However, the evidence in this case, her text message showing, connecting the bruising to her statement to her friend, essentially immediately after, in those 3 minutes when she was in the bathroom, shows that that was the startling event. Time does cut against us, though, if the sexual assault was the startling event. However, seeing the bruises could have also essentially restartled her, and she could have then been under the stress of the event, that restartling, when she made the statement.
Wouldn't that approach undercut your position? Here's my concern. If you've got a situation where she had remembered that the startling event was the sexual assault, and then the restartling event is a discovery of the bruises, why wouldn't that cause an observer to say that it was when she realized that there would be a physical manifestation of her sexual interaction with the accused that would be observed by her boyfriend, that from the time of the assault to this, she says, "Oh, my God, I've got to come up with an explanation for my boyfriend about why I've got hickeys and bruises."
If that was the scenario, Your Honor, which is not what came out on the record, then that would cut against an excited utterance, which is why we use the Arnold test, why we use the Donaldson factors to look at the totality of the circumstances. If that had been drawn out in her testimony, that the reason she made the statement or the reason she reported was to somehow fabricate, to cover in some form of adultery with a significant other, then that would cut against an excited utterance.
And so that's why it's so important that the startling event, you adopt the position that it is the discovery of the hickeys and bruises. Could also be argued, potentially, that it was after she had gone through the deductions. Oh, look, I've got hickeys and bruises. Wait a minute. I ended up naked in the other bed. I have vaginal soreness and so forth. The startling event is, oh, my God, I was sexually assaulted. But that's why it's important that either of those two events that occur within 3 minutes in the bathroom looking in the mirror, it really doesn't work if the sexual assault itself is the startling event.
It cuts against the analysis, Your Honor. Because we do have case law that states the longer the time frame between a remembered sexual assault and the statement, for an adult especially, does cut against an excited utterance. But in this case, the record shows that it was 3 minutes, and upon seeing the bruises, she was immediately sweating, shaking, and nauseous. And the reason the hearsay exception is important and determined to be trustworthy is because a person is under the stress of that event, and they don't have the time or ability to fabricate. They essentially blurt out a statement about what is occurring. And so that's why the excited utterance is trustworthy, a trustworthy exception to hearsay. And in this case, we have a 3-minute window where she's making those statements. Barring any additional questions on excited utterances, I'll move to legal sufficiency. So any rational trier of fact could find appellant guilty of sexual assault in this case because it lacked the cognitive ability to appreciate the nature of the conduct in question. She lacked the mental and physical ability to make and to communicate a decision regarding consent to appellant. We have detailed facts in this case about her inability to hold her urine on two different occasions immediately preceding the sexual act. She was unable to clean herself up. Appellant had to do that for her. In addition, appellant made a statement to OSI explaining how drunk she appeared, that she couldn't stand, sit up, or even unlock her phone, and she couldn't walk to the car or speak clearly. In addition, he told OSI that he lied, and he made a written statement explaining that he lied as well to OSI. The members were then given the false exculpatory statement instruction, and they were permitted to believe, as a result of that instruction, that they could find some of appellant's statements to be true while disbelieving others, such as his self-serving statements where he claimed that HS consented. In this case, the CCA determined that the mistake of fact as to consent defense was not at issue due to the particular charging scheme, and the defense of mistake of fact as to consent is baked in to an incapable of consenting offense. The government agrees with that analysis and the analysis in Teague, Rich, and Bannister from the service courts below that in those situations, a mistake of fact defense can be baked in and therefore is not an issue at trial. Barring any questions from the court, may I briefly conclude?
Please do.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, I think he rapes me was an admissible excited utterance, and the military judge did not abuse his discretion when he admitted it. A rational trier of fact, viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the government, could find appellant sexually assaulted. This court should affirm the decision of the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Thank you.
Thank you, Captain Wright. Mr. Hockenberry.
Your Honors, to start where government counsel started with the standard of review or perhaps with the level of deference to be applied here, which I think is an important point, the fact that there is evidence on the record from which a ruling could be made is not a substitute for an actual analysis of that record. And in the absence of any analysis, which I think is conceded, that slides the scale of deference down and closer to a de novo review, in which case, of course, this court would look to the evidence that is on the record. But the mere fact that the evidence is there is not a substitute for the analysis. And as this court and Your Honor said in Finch, when you don't have the benefit of the trial judge's analysis of the facts, you cannot grant the standard level of deference because you have no factual findings to review. And when you don't have the benefit of the judge's reasoning, there's no way to know if the military judge applied the correct law. So in this case,
isn't the military judge assumed to know the law, absent some indication in the record that he or she does not?
Your Honor, the military judge is certainly assumed to know the law, but this court's precedent is clear that in the absence of an articulated rationale and ruling on the record, less deference is applied.
Well, in practice, in the course of a trial, there are many objections raised. Generally, an objection may simply come out from the defense, irrelevant, Your Honor. Objection, hearsay. Objection, not competent. Is a judge supposed to stop and do an analysis and make findings on each one of those objections that come forth in the trial? It would be an awful long trial.
Well, Your Honor, that's a great point, and perhaps I don't know of any case law that would say a different level of deference or a different standard of review would be applied to an objection that was made and ruled on mid-trial as opposed to pre-trial or in a 39A like here.
So often the judge simply says sustain, or, you know, they say something else about the case, about the issue.
Absolutely. And move on. And, of course, in practice that's common, especially in cases where the objection just comes in the course of testimony and there's no 39A. I think it is somewhat incumbent upon the parties and the judge, but the parties as well, when there's an objection that's particularly legally intensive or particularly important, to do exactly what happened here. And say,
yeah, I think that's what I'm getting at. I'm asking you if whether or not this notion that the judge needs to stop and have an analysis made on the record applies only in a situation like this, where it does seem to be kind of an unusual ruling on an evidence or an unruling an uncommon evidentiary issue.
Right, and here there was a 39A and a hearing on this direct issue, and certainly opportunity where the judge should have made a more detailed ruling. I don't think that the requirement to make a ruling and the impact that would have on deference is limited to a situation like that, but the majority of objections that happen during a trial are likely not going to receive a great deal of appellate scrutiny, and probably the parties can anticipate which ones may be more likely to, and it would be incumbent upon them to seek out a more thorough ruling in those circumstances, which is exactly what happened here. Another formulation of the excited utterance standard is that it must rule out the possibility for conscious thought. And it's just difficult to understand how a statement like, "I think he raped me," which inherently involves a conscious thought process, it's in the statement itself, and is explicitly acknowledged to be the result of putting together and drawing conclusions from observations made throughout the day. It's just hard to understand how that statement could fit within that standard. Absent additional questions, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Hockenberry. The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand adjourned until further order of the court.
Court is adjourned until further order of the court.